Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Teresa Warden, registration number 41510. I'm here on behalf of Ford. I'm going to try to save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's up to you. You'll get the yellow light automatically at 5 minutes.
Okay. Nearly 30 years ago, the Colorado Supreme Court, in Camacho versus Honda Motor Company, held that the consumer expectation test is, quote, not the appropriate standard in Colorado for measuring whether a particular product is in a defective condition unreasonably dangerous to the consumer or user. Camacho held that a product's condition must be judged by weighing the risks of the challenged design with its benefits.
Excuse me, counsel, where did it say that it's not the appropriate standard? Can you give me a...
I believe it's page 1245, Camacho. It says, the obvious and foreseeable consumer contemplation test employed by the trial court and approved by the Court of Appeals is substantially similar to the open and obvious standard specifically rejected in Coos. It is not the appropriate standard in Colorado. Here, the trial court violated Colorado law by instructing the jury that they could find Mr. Walker's 1998 Ford Explorer driver's seat defective and unreasonably dangerous under either a consumer expectation or risk-benefit test.
Is that a discretionary decision by the trial court as to whether to instruct on both tests or one?
It's not, Your Honor, because it's an error of law. The trial court has discretion on the form of instructions, but they don't have discretion on instructing the jury on the correct principles of law. That's a decision that this court can review de novo because it's not a correct application of Colorado law.
What's the significance of the note on use in CJI which says that the tests are not mutually exclusive and both may be given in the appropriate case, although concededly the appropriate case isn't defined?
That note comes from the case of Biosera, which is a Colorado Court of Appeals case that came after Camacho. Biosera misinterpreted Camacho's holding as not precluding the consumer expectation test in the appropriate case. Here, there's 2 points. First, Camacho cannot be read as endorsing a consumer expectation test in any case. In 3 times in Camacho, on page 1245, the language I quoted earlier, page 1246, where the Camacho court says that the consumer expectation test is not a satisfactory test, and then page 1247, where it says it's particularly inappropriate test for cases involving technical products, the Camacho court was clear. Consumer expectation is not the law in Colorado. It's risk-benefit only. Even if Biosera were correct, however, this would not be an appropriate case for application of the consumer expectation test. In fact, evaluating the crashworthiness of any vehicle is about the furthest you can go from a product that could be evaluated by a consumer expectation test. To take, for example, many consumers may believe that when they are hit from the rear, that they will fly forward. That defies the laws of physics. So if a consumer is allowed to judge a product by their own beliefs, how can that be a fair test to manufacturers? And more importantly, how can manufacturers design products that are reasonably safe if they have to design to consumers' uninformed, subjective expectations?
Well, let me come back to this appropriate case test. And I'm not asking you to give up your argument that Camacho simply jettisons consumer expectation entirely. But if consumer expectation is appropriate in some cases but not others, why isn't that a discretionary decision of the trial court?
It's, I think that were the law of Colorado that it was appropriate.
Yeah, let's assume note 3 in the instructions to use is accurate. Wouldn't that be then a discretionary decision of the lower court?
It still wouldn't be no in this case, because it wouldn't be a correct interpretation even of Biosera to apply consumer expectation in this case. So that would still be a misapplication of Biosera of law if that were the law.
Thank you.
I don't understand your take on Biosera. Why would you say that Biosera goes against what the trial court did in this instance?
Biosera is what guided the trial court, Your Honor. I'm saying that Biosera, if it were the law, would not permit the result that occurred here, which is giving either the consumer expectation, allowing the jury to decide defect under either the consumer expectation test or the risk-benefit test. And it's important to remember that or, because that means that even if the jury agreed with Ford that the benefits of the energy-absorbing seat outweighed the risk, they could still find the product defective because it didn't meet their expectations. So you have a test where it shouldn't be defective under the correct test, but they're still finding defects under consumer expectation test.
So is it your position that there's nothing left of the consumer expectation test after Camacho?
In Colorado, that is law.
Well, there is some other language in Camacho that says total reliance on consumer contemplation test is inappropriate. There's some other language that can be read to indicate that the Supreme Court was not jettisoning the consumer expectation test altogether. I understand your position, and I have now found the sentence that you were quoting to, but there is other language, would you acknowledge, that indicates that you can still use both tests? You're not going to concede that, I understand.
That's not Ford's reading of Camacho, and that's supported in several ways. First, Camacho says in those two places, 1245 and 1246, it's not appropriate, it's not a satisfactory test, period. They don't say in cases involving complex products versus cases not involving complex products. Moreover, the passage in 1247 that's so often recited is Camacho reciting the holding in Ortho Pharmaceutical, which preceded that Camacho by a year, and there they said exclusive reliance on the consumer expectation test is particularly inappropriate in cases where the unreasonableness of the danger and the design defect and the efficacy of safety measures requires the consideration of scientific and technical information.
Well, what products are designed these days other than brooms that don't have scientific and engineering information involved in their design?
It's hard to think of a product that wouldn't be best suited to deciding its defect based on a risk-benefit test. Conceivably, is there a product out there that could be appropriately decided under a consumer expectation test? Maybe, but the same product could be decided defective under a risk-benefit test. It takes into account the correct factors, and that's what the Camacho Court was getting at, is that manufacturers have information that product liability law wants to encourage them to use to create safe products. By judging the product by that information rather than the knowledge of an ordinary consumer, you have a test that's fair to consumers and manufacturers and promotes the fundamental goal of product liability law, which is to encourage manufacturers to sell safe products.
In Camacho, did the Supreme Court expressly say that on remand, the jury shall be instructed only on the risk-benefit test?
I believe that was the import of their holding.
Did they expressly say that as opposed to that being an inference?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a case that went up on summary judgment. Honda had won summary judgment on the consumer expectation test, and the Camacho Court remanded the case and said that this has to be decided under the risk-benefit test, and that there was at least enough evidence going towards that test that it had to go to the jury and was not susceptible to summary judgment. And the same result occurred in White versus Caterpillar, which was a 1993 Colorado Court of Appeals case that preceded Biosera. There, the jury was instructed on a consumer expectation test alone. The White court looked at Camacho and said, Colorado follows the risk-benefit test, but particularly in a case like this where you have alternative designs at issue, the efficacy of safety features, you must make that determination under the risk-benefit test. Here, Mr. Walker used the consumer expectation test, inserting that those consumer expectations into the case to his advantage. He told the jury in closing, you don't have to decide who's right among the experts to decide if the seat is defective. That's something the risk-benefit test would have required the jury to do. Instead, he said, just use your common sense, take a look at that seat. Is that something you, as an ordinary consumer, would expect? And it may not be something that the ordinary consumer would expect, that their seat yields rearward in a crash, but it's something that's done by design to protect a consumer from the forces of the collision. The fact that the focus became the consumer expectation versus the risks and benefits, brought forward the opportunity to really show that their product was not defective and to prove that to the jury. The jury didn't have to focus on the hard questions, whether there was an alternative design that was available at the time that was feasible and that not only would have prevented Mr. Walker's injuries in this crash, but also would have provided better protection in other foreseeable crashes. Ford cannot design a seat that's just to protect Mr. Walker in 30-mile-per-hour rear collisions. It has to design a seat to protect occupants of all sizes, in rollovers, in frontal collisions, in double collisions of various speeds and magnitude. That's the kind of information the jury should have considered under the risk-benefit test, but they were excused from considering it because the consumer expectation test was in the case. Moreover, the fact that the jury returned a negligence verdict in plaintiff's favor doesn't make the error harmless for two reasons. One is Colorado law requires that whether proceeding in negligence or strict liability, a plaintiff in a product's liability case must prove that the product is defective. That determination cannot be made until the jury goes back and looks at the defect under the risk-benefit test alone. Had the jury returned a verdict for Ford for strict liability when correctly instructed, and for plaintiff in negligence, you would have had an irreconcilably inconsistent verdict. The second reason the negligence verdict doesn't make this error harmless is that the courts instructed the jury on manufacturer's duty to warn when there was no warning plaintiff in this case. There was no evidence of a warning that Ford should have given, a warning that would have prevented the injuries that Mr. Walker claims came from the seat. There was simply no warning at all. And by injecting that into the case, it could have misled the jury and they could have based their negligence verdict improperly on that warning.
I've looked at the verdict forms and I can't see how that would have affected the way they were filled out. Can you explain that to me, please?
You mean the fact that
they were instructed on failure to warn.
It could have affected it because we don't know whether they made a negligence finding on warning or design defect. Ford asked to separate those two claims in the verdict form, and the court denied that request. So we don't know which way the jury went, and if they went down the direction of warning, which is possible because of the instructions, there's no evidence to support that claim. Unless the court has further questions, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. Morning, may it please the court. My name is Mike Thompson, number 33592, and I, along with my co-counsel John Purvis, represent Forrest Walker in this claim. I'm going to jump in kind of right where we were leaving off there. In this case, I think the important, real important thing here is that both key decisions made by Judge Birkencotter in this case were discretionary decisions for her. It wasn't just the decision to give the consumer expectations test and the risk-benefit test, but it was also the decision to give the failure to warn test.
Was there any evidence supporting the failure to warn theory?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. Ford's own engineer, Roger Burnett, admitted that this is the way, in fact, Ford's case, the way they presented it was they admitted that they knew when they designed the cars that they collapsed on impacts of this sort. In fact, they assert that what happened in this case is entirely designed. So, but they did not warn about that design. That's the evidence for the failure to warn instruction.
Well, if the design is something that furthers, in Ford's view, the safety of the occupants, why would they warn about the safety of the occupants?
Well, that's certainly Ford's position, but I would tell you that the jury found in this case that it was a negligent decision on their part.
I understand that.
So Ford might have thought that.
But the question is whether or not it was within the court's discretion to give a failure to warn instruction.
Yeah, and what I would say, Your Honor, is that I believe that based on the evidence, the court found that a jury could find that they should have warned about the design. And what I'm getting at, though, on the discretionary decision here, is since it's a discretionary decision of Judge Birkencotter's in this case, there's no argument from Ford that the failure to warn instruction was contained, was an incorrect statement of law. It's a correct statement of law. It comes straight from the Colorado proposed jury instructions. And like I said, Ford's not even arguing it's an incorrect statement of law. But that means, based on the Hock decision, that this is a discretionary decision of the court. And also, most importantly, this is the distinction between the Hock case and the Jordan case, which defense counsel cites, is because it's a correct statement of law, the court in its review is to reconcile the decision of the jury with the instructions. If it had been an incorrect statement of law, Ford is correct. And then you go the other way and say, we don't know whether or not they used an incorrect instruction on this. But the failure to warn instruction is not incorrect on the law.
Did you present any evidence of what a proper warning would have been?
We did not introduce any evidence of what a proper warning would have been.
Thank you.
The other point I want to make with regards to the negligence claims that in this case is that Ford has talked about that there had to be a defect, for the jury had to find a defect under both situations. It's not exactly what the elements of the negligence claim are. The focus and the difference between a strict liability claim and a negligence claim and product liability is that in strict liability, the focus is on whether or not the product is defective. The negligence claim, the whole difference is it's about what the defendant did, whether or not their actions were negligent. In this case, the jury clearly found that Ford was negligent, that it had a proper definition for negligence, it had a reasonable care definition that these cases had, it had the causation instruction that these cases have. And additionally,
How could Ford be negligent if the product wasn't defective?
Well, under the element that they'd be negligent if they put a product into the stream of commerce that had an unreasonable risk of harm to it. It's slightly different language.
Is an unreasonable risk of harm the definition of defect?
I think so, as long as you recognize the definition of defect that Colorado law has, which is it's not just a functional defect, but it's more than that. It's this concept of unreasonably dangerous. It's not necessarily something broken in the product, that kind of thing. But what I'm getting at, important here on the definition side is, well, Ford was not surprised by the fact that we proposed both a negligence claim and a strict liability claim instruction. Ford did not propose a definition for the unreasonable risk of harm that's identified in the elements. They've complained that it isn't defined, but there was never a proposal from Ford for a definition of unreasonable risk of harm as it related into the negligence claim. Essentially, what comes down to here, though, in your questions, this all comes back to the instruction number 18, which is the definition that was given for defect or unreasonably dangerous product. What I think needs to be looked at here is this comes down to, it was six words. The so-called consumer expectations test is six additional words in that instruction. The jury's not told that they have two separate tests to consider. They are read an instruction that reads, has the words added to it, would not ordinarily be expected or. And I point that out because I don't think you can find that if you pull those six words out of that instruction, given all the other findings of this jury, that would change the decision that they made. The jury, in addition to these instructions, was provided the state of art instruction, which essentially summarized Ford's defenses in this case. Ford's primary defense in this case, from the words of their own engineer, Roger Burnett, was that in the mid-90s, they did not know that this was an issue. They did not, now they understand, now they build the seats a little stronger, this now up, the headrests are higher, a little bit more forward. But Roger Burnett did not, says that they did not know in the mid-90s that that was a better design. As we pointed out trial, their own expert from General Motors, Dr. David Biano, certainly knew that in the mid-90s. But the key point there is the jury was given the state-of-the-art instruction, which essentially wrapped up in a ball for Ford, their defense, and told, if you find this, if you agree with Ford's defense, the product is not dangerous. The jury did not find, did not side with Ford on that. They, despite the, both tests, that state-of-the-art instruction is not qualified to only apply to consumer expectations or only apply to risk benefit. It's there as an overall consideration for the jury as to whether or not this product is defective and unreasonably dangerous.
Well, excuse me, what is your response to your learned colleague's statement that Pust and Camacho completely got rid of the reasonable expectation test?
I not surprisingly disagree and would say my colleague did talk about it's been 30 years since that decision, and I would point out that in that 30 years there is not an appellate court that has held the giving of the consumer expectations test with the risk-benefit test as a reversible error.
Well, that's all well and good, but if the standing Colorado Supreme Court law says that it's gone, that you can't give it, then it doesn't matter that they haven't been reversed for it. Bound by Colorado Supreme Court law.
Yeah, I agree with you, obviously. If they had said that in Camacho, you'd be correct. I don't think they said that in Camacho. I think Camacho points out, and this is why the Biosera decision, which comes a decade later, holds that giving both of them at the same time it is fine and a discretionary decision of the court. If it had been ordered by the Supreme Court in 1987 in the Camacho case, the Biosera decision would have come out differently. And the Biosera decision was also had the chance of a Supreme Court review of it, and it was not taken up. So there have been opportunities for courts of appeals in this state to say that Camacho did that, and they haven't said that. And there's been other decisions, the Fiber Board decision from the Supreme Court in 1993, they didn't say that the consumer expectations test is gone. The consumer expectations test still lives, which is why it also still lives in the Colorado proposed jury instructions with a note regarding its appropriate use.
What about the White against Caterpillar case?
I, again, don't believe the White case threw it out. In the White case, the plaintiff intended to risk-benefit test, but the court only gave the consumer expectations test. It was found error not to give the risk-benefit test, but it was not said that it was error to give the consumer expectations test. An interesting point of this issue is it's been made to sound in the appellant's briefing that this consumer expectations test is kind of an end-all be-all win for plaintiffs in product liability cases. The actual fact of the matter is Camacho was a plaintiff complaining that they didn't, that the consumer expectations test was unfair to the plaintiff. In fact, there are a couple other cases since Camacho where that was the case as well. Plaintiffs in the Bartholic federal case and I'm forgetting which, but there's another one, I think it might have been White. Yeah, where the plaintiff was actually the one seeking the risk-benefit test. And the issue being there is that plaintiffs were concerned that a consumer could think a product has its issues, since they expect them, they're fine with it, not realizing that in the science of the matter is that a product could pretty easily be made safer without any more expense. That's why in Camacho, the plaintiffs wanted the risk-benefit test given. It's not that this idea that somehow the consumer expectations test just means plaintiffs will win every time. In fact, which leads to the argument there, which was referenced the restatement third of towards the product liability portion, is that somehow consumers will say, we just don't want to be hurt. That's our expectation. If we're hurt, the product's defective. Well, in this case, the jury's also given the standard instruction, which is, it's not enough. Just because someone's hurt doesn't mean the product's defective. They were told that as well. There has to be more. There was a very specific instruction given to them that there has to be more than just you finding Mr. Walker was hurt, so there must have been something wrong with the product. There's been talk of the plaintiff somehow had a lack of evidence presented in the case for causation and other issues, which somehow ties in with their arguments that the jury, that's how, why the jury came to this decision. But that's just simply not true in this case. There was a host of information that backed up the jury's decision in this case. Paul Lewis and our engineer Ken Brown testified about alternative designs in the 1996 Sebring, the Volvo vehicle. But honestly, most importantly in this case, the alternative seat design came from the defendant's own expert, Dr. David Deanna, who had a long history starting in the 80s into the early 90s, in which he designed effectively the seat that, which is now our state-of-the-art seat design, which is a higher head restraint, a much more forward, so it carries your head back. You just knock the whip back before you hit it, but it's also high enough to catch your head. And so we got those alternative designs in, and Paul Lewis came in and explained for the jury why that would have kept Mr. Walker's worst injuries from happening. And it's based on Mr. Lewis's experience in investigating literally thousands of these vehicle accident cases, that had the seat been a Sebring or a Volvo or one of Dr. Viano's designs, that Mr. Walker's injuries would have been whiplash type, sprain, strain type stuff. And he identified the specific stuff that he wouldn't have had, which is the ligament injuries in his neck and his brain injury, which are far more, those are the serious injuries in this case. Those are the reasons Mr. Walker can't work. That's the critical stuff. But the idea that somehow plaintiff didn't present evidence of this doesn't stand up to what the actual facts are. And we've tried to point that out in the rather lengthy statement of facts that we put together from what happened at trial. Dr. Viano, years ago, not just for this trial, set out a list, and again, this is Ford's own expert, of what the best seat design was. And he started with strong seat back, high head restraint, and low stiffness. That was the best seat. Down near the bottom, so the first two best are strong seat backs. Then the third is weak seat back with a high head restraint, and then a weak seat back with a low head restraint. He says it's the fourth worst design, and that I believe there was evidence in this case. The jury was able to see the seats, but they could have decided themselves that this seat was down there at the bottom of the design list, and that's why Ford was negligent in this case. In closing, I refer your court back to the state-of-the-art instruction. The jury was given an opportunity to agree with Ford's position and its defenses in finding the product wasn't unreasonably dangerous. They got very specific instruction to do that, and they did not do it. They found them negligent, and they found that the product was unreasonably dangerous. Thank you for your time.
I want to start by addressing the point that Colorado law doesn't require finding a defect under negligence or strict liability. Clearly does. The case is Mile High Concrete, 842 P. 2nd, 198 at page 205, and it is cited in the briefs. And that's important because, as Judge Webb noted, Ford cannot be negligent for designing a non-defective product. Camacho says that clearly, that the standard of care that manufacturers are held to is to design reasonably safe products. Strict liability takes the focus away from the conduct of the manufacturer, but it also takes the focus away from the conduct of the consumer. And that's what Camacho said. Colorado needs a test that will focus on the product. The risk-benefit test does just that. Mr. Walker's counsel also didn't acknowledge the or in the jury instruction, number 18, could decide whether the risks were different than an ordinary consumer would expect, I think I got the language slightly wrong, or were outweighed by the benefits. That's important because a jury can decide under either test, and this court can't speculate which one they follow. The Jordan versus Bogner case is particularly instructive there. That was a medical malpractice case where the jury was instructed both on a specialist standard of care and a non-specialist standard of care. The court said the specialist standard was the correct one. All of the evidence went to the specialist standard of care, and the Colorado Supreme Court still reversed and remanded for a new trial because it said that it's legally impossible to decide whether the jury followed the correct instruction or the incorrect one. That's the same result that we have here. Finally, Ford did tender an alternate instruction for negligence that would require the jury to make a finding of defect. That instruction, that tendered instruction was denied by the court. And I think that the record sites are on footnote 14, page 29. Ford also argued that negligence shouldn't go to the jury at all because it's basically a duplicative claim and it could invite an inconsistent verdict. Ultimately, this verdict, if it were left to stand, endorses a rule that is contrary to Colorado law, longstanding Colorado law. Biosera muddied the waters and created a pattern jury instruction that does not reflect the law of Colorado. This is going to keep coming up again and again until this court fixes it. Thank you very much. We request that you reverse the verdict and enter judgment for Ford starting in an orderly trial. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will wish you